Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take to expand the Wall Street Journal's coverage from a focus on business stories alone and to expand its influence to a global audience? My guest today is uniquely qualified to answer those questions since he played a critical role in the evolution. Warren H. Phillips first went to work for the Wall Street Journal as a copy reader in 1947. 3 years later, at the age of 23, he was London bureau chief and continued to rise through the ranks as foreign editor, news editor, managing editor, and finally Wall Street Journal publisher and CEO of Dow Jones & Company. When Phillips was named CEO in 1975, the paper had a daily circulation of 1.4 million. By the time he left in 1991, that number had risen to over 2 million, and revenues of parent company Dow Jones had grown to more than sixfold. Phillips writes about his life and career in his new memoir, Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at the Wall Street Journal. Warren, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Glad to be on your show.
So as young as you were when you actually started professionally as a journalist, the interest that you had in journalism started even earlier. Can you tell us what you remember about a trip your father took you on, a tour of the New York Daily News when you were 11?
Yes, we went. The New York Daily News was running tours, and I remember seeing this huge globe rotating in the lobby, and then seeing the reporters hunched over their typewriters in the newsroom, and the mammoth presses in the basement, and that had a very subtly seductive effect on me, and I was hooked from that point on.
And not long after, you started your own newspaper out of your bedroom, I guess.
Yeah, I was sick with pneumonia at the time, and I started a newspaper for the family on a kid's typewriter, and it was titled The Snoopy Scoop. And in typical childish fashion, it had the motto, everywhere we snoop until we get a scoop. And I guess I carried that on into later life.
So you graduated from high school, was it 14?
Yes, that's right.
That must have been tough at that age to sort of be taken seriously by your peers. Was that something that experience sort of helped you later on?
Well, yeah, my peers took me seriously enough. It was the girls that didn't take me seriously enough because they were all older than I was, Chris. But some people have said subsequently, I don't know that I'm so self-analytical that I noticed at the time, but they said that, you know, continuing on at that age and with older students displayed a sort of tenacity, and maybe that came in handy in later life.
So when you graduated from college, you ended up at the Wall Street Journal, and this is one of those stories almost like, you know, the famous actor that wasn't cast in some minor role. Lots of other papers turned you down, and the Wall Street Journal was the only one that would hire you.
Yeah, and in New York, there were about 11 general circulation newspapers at that time, a long list of them, most of whom have expired, and I went from one to the other, and they were full up. And eventually I wound up at the Journal, which at that time was really a very small stock market sheet with a circulation of just about 100,000. And they hired me, and I felt very fortunate.
And at the time, you were what was known in those days as a copy boy. You were working as a proofreader?
No, I was a copy boy before that at the New York Herald Tribune. While I was going to college, or for a while full-time between the Army and going back to college, and then weekends while I was at college. And in that job, you fetched coffee for the reporters, you took their copy from their desks to the city desk and did chores of that sort. When I was hired at the Journal, that's when I was a proofreader for a couple of months before going on to the copy desk.
You know, what's really amazing is that these days the path to a career at a newspaper like the Wall Street Journal almost never originates at the Wall Street Journal. Young journalists will hone their skills at smaller papers around the country and sort of job hop until they get up to the biggest ones. Do you think, pros and cons to the way it happens now as opposed to your ability to stay with the same publication for all that time?
Well, at the time that I was at the Journal and the time that I was managing editor, we did hire people fresh out of college. And when I was running the Chicago Bureau, we hired people fresh out of college who had promise. And some of them were terrific. Al Hunt, who later became Washington Bureau Chief for the Journal, we hired him when he graduated from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I'd like to think that some of that still goes on today, but I guess there's less and less of it and more demand for experienced people.
How did you end up at the London Bureau in 1950?
Well, I quit the Journal in 1949 to go to work on the copy desk at the Stars and Stripes in Germany because I wanted to see the world, so to speak, while I was still young. Mm-hmm. And I did freelance stories from Germany for the Journal, and they rehired me as a correspondent in Germany when their staff correspondent was rotated home. So I worked in Germany for about a year and then went to help out in the London Bureau during an election there. It was supposed to be a temporary assignment, but sadly the London Bureau chief died while I was there, and it was about a 3 or 4 man bureau at that time. They picked me to run the London Bureau.
Huge amount of responsibility, even with a small bureau on the shoulders of someone so young. Did you have the confidence that you could do it, or did that sort of come as you found yourself successfully completing the work?
I think I gained confidence certainly the year before in Germany as I saw more and more of my stories getting into the paper. I mean, those were lively years in Europe. We rode the Berlin airlift into Berlin on army transport planes filled with coal. We got the editors assigned me to go to Greece, go to Turkey during the time they were fending off communist attempts to extend Soviet influence to the south. I was in the mountains in northern Greece during the winding down of the civil war, and getting stories about those experiences into the paper week after week does tend to bolster one's confidence. So I didn't have too much lack of that by the time I was in London.
What a phenomenal education that must have been, all that travel at such a young age.
Well, as you know from your own career, you know, the great advantage in journalism is that you are paid to have a continuing education, because each story, each subject you tackle creates an opportunity, in fact a necessity, for you to research it and learn about that subject, and then you go on to another subject and another story, and it becomes a lifetime of nonstop education.
We should say here that another really wonderful thing that happened to you while you were working in London was that you met the woman who would become your wife.
That's right. That's right. And still is my wife.
Yes.
That was my greatest achievement.
She was working for a professor at the time?
She was working for a gentleman who was a physicist who headed up an organization attached to the American Embassy called the Office of Naval Research. And that was mostly staffed by other scientists. And their job was to poke around in the labs and the universities of Europe and look for practical research and theoretical research that might be employed to help the U.S. Navy develop defensive and offensive weapons.
And did either one of you realize at the time how much time and effort, and in some cases time away from your family, your career would ultimately take?
I don't think we had any sense of that at the time, because we didn't really have a family mm-hmm. yet. I think that became evident later on.
So you went back to New York at 25 as news editor for the Wall Street Journal, is that correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then after that?
I went back initially as foreign editor, and then I was news editor for about a year.
And were you, as news editor, interested in sort of changing the way the paper covered stories?
No, not at that time. The man who was really responsible for the evolution of the modern Wall Street Journal was a man named Barney Kilgore, who was the publisher at the time I was in New York, and he previously had been managing editor. And he developed the concept that business news did not have to be dull, that it wasn't just for bankers and manufacturers, that it affected all of us in our everyday lives, and he wanted the news written that way. And I was happy to try to conform to that, what at the time was a revolutionary concept on his part.
Was the Wall Street Journal a place when you were starting there that really did sort of mentor people coming up through the ranks? Because I know you had a great relationship with Barney Kilgore. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, yes, I worked more closely with some of his lieutenants, and they were very sharing in helping young people develop and telling them what the paper needed, and they were. I'm very indebted to them for every step along the way. There was a lot of mentoring going on, and I hope there still is in all kinds of organizations.
So when you went to Chicago to serve as managing editor of the Midwest Edition, this was the first capacity in which you had to deal not only with journalists and journalism, but also with some non-news sort of business corporate issues that came up.
Yeah, the managing editor in the Midwest Edition and in the Southwest Edition in Dallas at that time, mm-hmm. which had been started a couple of years earlier, they had the authority, if a decision had to be made under deadline pressure that crossed departmental lines, they were the final word. And that really didn't come up often, but the authority was there.
How did those regional editions at the time differ from what was published in New York?
At that time, they really did not differ much because the news was moved on teletype machines, originally starting in 1929 to an edition on the Pacific Coast in San Francisco. Then about, I'd say around 1958 to Dallas, and later to, earlier than that, to Dallas, and then to Chicago. And we would pretty much put in the paper what was being published in the New York paper. Some of it, of course, had originated in Chicago or in Dallas, and then come back to us for inclusion in our paper.
So in 1957, you're 30 years old, you're named managing editor of the paper itself. What were the obligations of that job?
Well, you're in charge, of course, of the hiring of the news staff, the training of the news staff, the setting of standards, and the enforcement of those standards of accuracy, fairness, credibility. That was a key part of it. And then, of course, you had the strategist's role of deciding what stories, particularly types of stories, would or would not be covered. And that's where I had an opportunity to broaden out our coverage.
Warren H. Phillips is my guest. He's former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and CEO of Dow Jones & Company. His new memoir is called Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at the Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's certificate program in financial planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Warren H. Phillips. He's former publisher of The Wall Street Journal and CEO of Dow Jones & Company. His new book is called Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at The Wall Street Journal. If you want to be part of this conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Warren, talk about your focus in terms of broadening the paper's coverage. You wanted to be certain that there was a news connection to the stories that you published, but you included in that news connection, things like education and medicine and science and social issues. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, the journal had pretty much been focused on almost exclusively on business and, of course, on politics and on Washington, and a bit of foreign affairs, because those things affected business. Very soon after I became managing editor, we had the integration of the schools in Little Rock, where Governor Faubus defied a court order and President Eisenhower sent troops down. Now, that was a social issue which we might not have covered before, but I did send a team down to cover that, and we did on the theory that you cannot separate what's going on in terms of racial conflict in the South, racial conflict in the North, those changes in our society that are watersheds like that. You can't separate that from your readers' lives or from American business either.
But that was a subject for debate within the paper. Were there people who said this is getting off what we need to be covering?
I don't recall that. You know, maybe there were some, but maybe they didn't express themselves very loudly. But anyway, that's not part of my memory bank.
Mm-hmm. So talk about your expansion into foreign markets. Lots of deals taking place with Asia, lots of expanded coverage there.
Yes, we started a joint venture with the Associated Press initially to do a business wire service around the world, but we started it initially in Japan because one of the Japanese news agencies bought the service and got us started economically, and that soon spread to 30 countries, 40 countries, 50 countries in the years afterwards. At the same time, we saw the Asian economy expanding so much more rapidly even than Europe was, and we did start an Asian edition of the journal in Hong Kong, and that later was also printed in publishing plants in Tokyo and in Singapore and elsewhere. And some years after that, we took that same model, I guess that's the modern word, to Europe and started the Wall Street Journal Europe in Brussels, with subsequent printing in Switzerland, London, and other points to get fast distribution over a broad area.
So suddenly you have this global reach, but there's also a lot of different sources of competition to think about.
Yes, the competition was a lot stronger in Europe, and I suppose that was a factor in why we started in Asia. Asia was not only growing faster, but Asia was pretty much an open field for us when we started there. Later, we came into Europe, and of course, we came up against the Financial Times and against the International Herald Tribune. But I think that we did well in that competition, and the paper continues to do so. So the journal was converted really into a global newspaper during those years. And this was not any brilliant idea of mine. I mean, this was the idea of people on the ground, like Peter Kahn, who was in Hong Kong at that time, Don McDonald, who was our marketing chief. I mean, they saw the possibilities, and I signed on, but I was not the originator.
You write candidly about a severe depression that you had to overcome in the early 1970s, which sort of took you by surprise in that things in your life were going quite well.
Yeah, this was 1972. I had just been appointed president and chief operating officer of Dow Jones. I had a trip to China coming up, but China was just beginning to open up after the Nixon breakthrough, and I was scheduled to go to China. And this depression hit me during the summer, and it was not pleasant, as anyone who has ever had a clinical depression can tell you. And I was very fortunate in that with the help of some antidepressants, I was able to overcome that.
And this was a time when you couldn't really, people didn't speak openly about issues like depression in the way that they do now.
That's right. I didn't put the doctor bill in for medical insurance because I was not anxious to have that become a source of gossip coming from the personnel department, perhaps into the rest of the company. And, you know, Chris, I'm not sure that even though we've overcome some of that stigma, I'm not sure that a lot of it does not still exist today.
That people get branded somehow unreliable if they've coped with mental illness in the past?
Yeah, it's unfortunate, it's unfair, but it's no different, really, than a physical illness. People will look at it differently than they will someone who has had pneumonia or diabetes.
Remarkably, you did, despite dealing with this that year, you did get to China and do a great deal of sort of on-the-ground reporting, which I gather you hadn't been able to do for several years previous to that.
That's right. I went with a group from the American Society of Newspaper Editors. We were there for 3 weeks, a little over 3 weeks, and I managed to do a fair, I'd say about 15 front page stories for the journal on different aspects of Chinese life, and that gave me a spiritual high in the sense that I felt that after all those years of being behind a desk editing, I had managed to keep my hand in as a reporter. So that was a source of great satisfaction.
And then in 1975, you were named publisher, which is the same title that today also goes along with being CEO. Talk about, when you got the job, did you have goals and think, I'm going to change this, this, and this? Or, you know, having been there for so long, you didn't need to stand back and assess things. Or was it somehow different when you were in charge of everything?
No, I'm not the reflective type. I guess I should be. I didn't sit back and say, here's how I'm going to change things. And one reason for that is that my predecessors had done such a magnificent job of putting the journal and Dow Jones on a path to growth, and the paper was doing so well in terms of all the reader surveys that showed great satisfaction with it. I was just anxious to keep up to those standards that they had set.
How did the advent of satellite and other digital technologies change the way that you were able to serve your audience?
Well, that's a good question. People have lost sight of that now because they're so used to the satellite technology. But our engineers and our production people, a young man named Bill Dunn and his colleagues, they saw the potential as America put satellites into space. And techniques were developed by the government scientists for compressing the data gathered by those satellites so that it could be transmitted back to Earth quickly. They saw that as enabling them, which they did, develop equipment to compress the data on the journal's pages and transmit that quickly to remote locations. And so from publishing plants in Dallas, San Francisco, and Chicago that were served by teletype, over the years we developed 18 plants in the United States and others in Europe and Asia that could receive their stories and advertising by satellite and get it to readers on day of publication. And that ability to speed the paper to readers on day of publication was a very important part in the journal's growth at home and abroad.
And then in the mid to late 80s, the Wall Street Journal expanded into providing real-time financial data. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Even before that, again, our engineers, because I'm certainly no technician, but they developed the means to retrieve news via computers and put that news on people's desktop terminals, and that became a growing business. And then we later got into providing it in real time.
Of course, there was stiff competition from early on from people like Bloomberg and Reuters. Had you anticipated that other firms would come along and be able to do the same thing so quickly?
Yes, I think we anticipated that because some of those firms were already in action, but we underestimated what the challenge would be, and so that was not a very successful venture at the time. It subsequently came a cropper, but the paper is very active in providing real-time data today. It has a Wall Street Journal online edition, just as you have an online edition for your stations. And that is one of the more successful newspaper online sites in existence.
So you left in 1991. At that point, how serious were the discussions about the dawn of the age in which in many cases, even a majority of people who would read your paper's stories every day would consume them online rather than from a hard copy?
Well, the discussions were there, but we always thought that online editions, digital delivery of the news would be a supplement to newspapers and not a substitute for newspapers. And as things have rapidly developed, it's both. For many in the younger generations, getting news online has become a substitute for newspapers, but at the same time, newspapers continue to not only exist in print, but to establish very vigorous online editions so that one supplements the other.
So many people are concerned about, you know, the online editions and the issues with revenue, but the Wall Street Journal has been able to sell online subscriptions from the time they began offering those.
I think that's, I know that's correct. We were the only one for a long while that charged for our content, and I think that reflected two things. One was that we were dealing in business news and financial news where timely information was a necessity. People needed to have it as rapidly as possible. And secondly, it was trustworthy information. The credibility of the journal carried over to what it was doing online and still does.
What do you think being a journalist at the very top of the organization at Dow Jones and at the Wall Street Journal, what advantage did that give to the people who worked for you and the coverage you were able to provide?
Well, the people who worked for me would have to speak for themselves as to whether whether they felt I was an advantage or not. It certainly was an advantage to me, having been a journalist, to be able to sit at the table and discuss with the editors the types of coverage and the quality of the coverage that they were doing in a way that somebody up from the financial side or the advertising side could not do. I had earned my spurs, so to speak, and I felt that I had the qualifications, and I guess they did too, to participate in those discussions. And I don't think they would have had the same attitude towards someone who really didn't know what he was talking about in terms of having been there himself.
Well, they knew that you had their back when it came to, you know, being independent of the sales side, I guess.
Yes, I mean, that's true, because the greatest thing that the Journal or any newspaper has to offer its readers is reliable information, and the readers had to feel that there was integrity in that information, that it was independent of advertiser pressure, other business pressures, pressures from government, and we had a number of run-ins over the years in which I defended that independence, and they knew that I was there at their back.
Are the resources today, technological resources, do they make it easier to tell good stories in a timely fashion, or are the pressures that exist on journalism making it harder?
Well, I think I'm not speaking from firsthand experience now because I'm retired from that, but I can't see that the technology today can do anything but help reporters and newspapers in their work. I mean, all of the search methods for getting information and background and research quickly, we never had them in the earlier years, and that's got to be of tremendous value.
When you left the Wall Street Journal, were you nervous about the idea of not being there every day?
No, I left there at age 65, and I felt that at the Journal, as in any organization, there comes a point when one should let the younger people take over and grow in their own right and get the stewardship of the paper and the organization, and they did so admirably.
Warren H. Phillips is my guest. He's former publisher of The Wall Street Journal and CEO of Dow Jones & Company. His new memoir is called Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at The Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Warren H. Phillips, former publisher of The Wall Street Journal and CEO of its parent company, Dow Jones & Company. His new memoir is called Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at The Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. One thing that absolutely changed, Warren, in the time that you were at the Journal was the role of women and their equality within newsrooms. Can you talk a little bit about how that played itself out at the Journal?
Yes. When I joined the paper originally, there were women on the staff who had mostly come on during World War II when the men were off fighting. And the same thing in the period when I was a copy boy at the Herald Tribune. There were a lot of women there who had filled in for the men during the war. After the war, when the men came back, the women tended to go back to marriage and domestic duties, and there weren't many of them. But we hired some, and the women we hired felt we were not hiring enough of them, and we were not promoting them fast enough, and they had a valid point in that, and we tried to do better in that area because I had three daughters at home and a wife who was very much for equal opportunity for women, and I heard it at home and I heard it at the office, and I think over time we did better, but we didn't do well enough. And it's ironic because in the same period that we were moving rather slowly at work, I was busy fighting to open up some of the clubs I belong to, such as the University Club in New York, to women membership, and getting booed by the male members for my efforts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Terry in Dallas. Hello, Terry.
Hello. I have two questions. One is, how long were you there as the editor? And number two, there's Rupert Murdoch, who's taken over the Wall Street Journal and Barron's. Has he exerted any influence over the policies of the paper and the magazine?
Okay, good questions. I was there as managing editor and executive editor at the Journal for 15 years, and then I was publisher another 15 years, and my total time at the paper came to about 45 years. And I've watched with interest Murdoch purchasing Dow Jones in the 2007, because Murdoch has been demonized by a great many people for using his newspapers, or allegedly using his newspapers, to further his own commercial or political agenda. And although I'm not there and can't speak firsthand, as a reader of the Journal, and certainly from the contact I have with staff members who still are there, that has not taken place at the Journal, because, and I believe it has not taken place because the trust of the Journal's readers in the paper's credibility, is the greatest asset it has. And I think Mr. Murdoch is a smart enough guy to understand that and to know that if he started trying to bend its editorial policy or its news coverage to his own interests, as he's been accused of doing with some of his tabloids and mass circulation popular newspapers, if he tried to do that at the Journal, the readers would sense that and would lose confidence in the paper, and it would be less respected, less influential than it remains today. So I think the Journal's fortunate in having avoided that, at least up to now.
He certainly has put money into the Wall Street Journal.
And I think that's a great blessing, because he is passionate about newspapers, and he's been willing to put money into building staff and expanding the space devoted to expanded coverage in these recent years, when with circulation, particularly advertising, declining in general, almost every newspaper I can think of around the country, including some of the biggest and the greatest, have had to cut staff, cut their space, and have been losing circulation, whereas the Journal remains the largest circulation newspaper in the country, and the last time I looked, its circulation was the only one still growing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Meg on the line in Dallas. Hello, Meg.
Hi. We love your program.
Thank you.
I'd like your guest to expand on why, with the Wall Street Journal having the information on Madoff for 3 years, why was it not ever covered by the Wall Street Journal, according to the movie?
Well, let's just so we Warren may want to comment on this, but he was not with the Wall Street Journal at the time that this story was taking place. But do you have a comment for Meg by any chance?
Well, you know, Meg, to tell you the God honest truth, this is the very first time that I've ever heard anyone say that the Journal had the goods on Madoff for 3 years. I know the Securities and Exchange Commission had it and bungled it, but I have never heard anyone on or off the staff indicate that they had anything on Madoff, because if they had it, they wouldn't have covered it up. They would have put it out there. You know, Meg, just as a sideline, people have asked me in recent years, because I spend the winter in Florida near where Madoff lived, people come up to me and say, did you lose any money with Madoff? And I tell them, I said, I didn't need Madoff to lose money. I can manage that all by myself.
What do you think about the pros and cons of what today is inarguably a 24-hour news cycle? Are we really getting more information, or are we just getting more sort of facts and thoughts thrown at us?
Well, I think you've got two elements there. One is the 24-hour news cycle, and the other is the plethora of different blogs and news sites and others saying that they are presenting the news. There's a multitude of them now, some very qualified to do so and some not. I think the plus is that readers can get news fast, and if it's news that they need in their personal or business lives or to make political judgments, that's a plus. The challenge is to make sure that what gets out on the wire or the internet is as accurate and as reliable as what comes out in the paper after layers of editors have had a chance to look at it, to screen it, to check it, and make sure that it's fair and accurate. The need for speed has to be balanced against the need for care.
I'm curious about how you go through the paper or papers you read every day. Do you always sit down with them at a certain time, and do you read certain sections first? How does that work for you?
Oh, I mostly read a few papers in the morning, and I start with the front page, and I pretty much have a hunger for everything that's there. I read the business parts. I read the arts parts. I look in the index that the Wall Street Journal continues to run that some other papers have dropped, and see if there's some subject I'm interested in or some company I'm interested in that's covered there. I think I read it pretty much as any of the other readers do, maybe with a little more critical eye.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can never quite shake the editor in you as you go through a newspaper.
Yeah, that's true. If you see something that looks like it is not balanced, and it looks like it's slightly tilted ideologically, never in the journal, of course, never. But if you see that in some other paper, you know, it sends a red flag up. If you see a good story that's put on page 24 and you think should be on the front page, that gets your instincts up. And I think it's probably the same way when you listen to other news broadcasts and talk shows.
Absolutely. So we talked about you retiring from the Wall Street Journal, but you didn't come close to actually retiring. Once that was over, you and your wife started a publishing company.
Yeah, we started publishing books. We started a small press called Bridgeworks Publishing Company, and we've done some books on public issues, drug issues, immigration issues, some biographies, certainly Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president before women could even vote in the late 19th century. We did a biography of her. But mostly what we published, and certainly exclusively in more recent years, is fiction, novels. And they have won recognition, and we've been very pleased by that.
It must be wonderful to be able to work together after all this time.
Yes, that's been a real benefit and a blessing, and we've enjoyed it.
And what's the difference when you're looking when you're trying to look at a really good novel as compared with a news story? Obviously, they're very different things, and yet good writing is good writing. I mean, how many of your skills from journalism are brought to bear on your work with publishing?
Well, not the journalistic skills, because my wife is the editorial director, mm-hmm. and she has a really good eye. She, over the years, has had articles of hers published in national magazines. She's had short stories published and a short story collection published, and she used to teach English literature, and she has a really good eye on the literary side and picks the authors and picks the manuscripts that we will publish, and she does the editing. I more or less defer to her and go to the business side and do the marketing, the distribution, the production, publicity. I hope if we have a good book to publish, I'll get your ear someday, Chris.
So you are modest in this conversation about your achievements, and certainly you're modest in the book. I wonder if someone else had to convince you to write this memoir, if it was something that you have wanted to do for a long time.
No, actually, I resisted doing it over the years after I retired, because I thought it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, you know, and who cares? Who'd want to read it? But after the passage of time, and it's now quite a few years since I retired, I began to reflect on the experiences I had had, the types of people I had met in journalism, editors of other papers, staff members, and people outside journalism, people in public life that I had met. And I thought, well, you know, there are some lessons in those experiences that are really as relevant today as they were then. I mean, this idea of performance, how well the press performs and its credibility, is certainly as big an issue today as it ever was in the past. The idea of protecting the press from governmental and business and other pressures is as relevant today as in the past. So I thought I would do this book, Newspaper Man, which really is two things. It's a behind-the-scenes look at how the Wall Street Journal was built into the largest paper in the country, the antics of the people who built it. Some were brash, some were irreverent, some were the exact opposite. And, you know, all the different crises and crossroads and controversies we had along the way. A behind-the-scenes look at how the paper was built. And at the same time, more personal story of the experiences I had as a foreign correspondent, as managing editor, and then as publisher, and the different things I encountered that are as relevant today as they were in the past. Because
I'm afraid we'll have to jump in here because we're out of time. Warren H. Phillips is former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and CEO of Dow Jones & Company. His new book is called Newspaper Man, Inside the News Business at the Wall Street Journal. Warren, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.